Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
On the one hand, you have a woman who doesn't want to be pregnant, and she can fix the problem, but the only way she can fix the problem is by taking a human life.
When there is antinomianism present or gospel reductionism, even from our own experience with Seminex, all sorts of mischief arises.
I'm really concerned that what you're suggesting is that we should give our own words and our own paraphrase to people when they're suffering in place of Jesus' word.
If you think you're going to attract them by being evangelical in worship style, they will smell you so fast because they smell that you really wanted to be what they are leaving.
An hour from now, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. That's four soundbites we're going to play for you in their entirety. And then after you've listened to the four soundbites, you give us a call, 1-877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or vote at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and your votes will decide which will be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. How do we get to the point where we can hear a major party presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton, refer to an unborn person as having no human rights? A person with no rights. I ask the question, what are the kinds of persons have no human rights? What are the kind of human beings should be deemed as worthy of less than the full protection of the law based upon their intrinsic value and human rights? So how do we get to these questions? Well, it's the end of a very, very long road that many people who say such things don't even realize they themselves have traveled. We're going to be talking about secular philosophies and the culture of death. Joining us on this Friday afternoon, Dr. Richard Weikart. He's professor of modern European history at California State University, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, and author of the new book, The Death of Humanity and the Case for Life. Dr. Weikart, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You begin your latest book quoting Viktor Frankl, a survivor of the Holocaust at Auschwitz, saying this, and I want to know why you include this rather startling statement at the beginning of your book. It says the gas chambers of Auschwitz were ultimately the consequence of the theory of man that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or as the Nazis like to say, of blood and soil. I am absolutely convinced that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek were ultimately prepared not in some ministry or other in Berlin, but rather at the desks and in the lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers. Why do you begin that way?
Well, of course, I've done a lot of work myself on Nazi Germany. I teach courses on it. I've written extensively on Nazi Germany before. And one of the things that people seem to be confused about is they tend to think that Hitler and many of their Nazi leaders were these people who were buying into what they call pseudoscience, or these weird, wild, outlandish ideas that are on the fringes of society. What they don't realize is, and Frankl's quotation brings this, I think, to bear on this subject, they don't realize that a lot of these ideas that Hitler was putting forward were ideas that were being hatched in the universities of the day. Ideas about racial superiority and inferiority were widespread among anthropologists. We're talking about professional anthropologists at German universities, and German universities, by the way, were considered the pinnacle of the university systems in the entire world. People would go from the United States, Britain, and elsewhere to study there. So many of these ideas that became so horrific in their application in Nazi Germany were ideas that were being spread by the universities. And so, I mean, the warning there is then that the same thing could happen today. And, of course, I'm not saying that today we are Nazis. I'm not trying to make that point. And, by the way, I do talk in my introduction about a lot of different kinds of ideas other than just the Nazis. They're just one among others. But nonetheless, I mean, we need to be aware that things that are being said at the highest echelons of academe today that might seem shocking to many people today, they're going to filter down to society if they're not stopped.
So of all the philosophies we could discuss, and of all the philosophies we will in the course of our conversation here, which one has had the greatest influence toward a culture of death and the dehumanizing of humanity?
Well, that's difficult to say for a number of things, but the place that I see is sort of the historical pivot, and the reason I would choose this particular philosophy is because it sort of is grounded there and also is a more overarching theory. I mean, I would say materialism in general because it's a more overarching kind of ideology, but there are all sorts of different varieties of materialism too, and I discuss a lot of different varieties of materialism. What happened was in the 18th century, a group of thinkers that became known or known today among historians as the Radical Enlightenment emerged, and many of these were materialists, and I discuss these extensively in the opening chapter of my book, which is called Man the Machine, after the introduction. In Man the Machine, I talk about how they began to conceive of a universe without God, and because of the universe was without God, they thought, this also meant that humans are nothing other than a mechanism that's been produced, and as time was going to go on, most of these materialists were going to believe, as most do today, that humans were just the accidental process of the cosmos, that they have no purpose, no meaning, no significance in any kind of cosmic sense. And in fact, the title of my first chapter, Man the Machine, is actually the title of a book that was written by Julien Delametrie, who was a famous French materialist in the mid part of the 18th century, is part of this radical enlightenment that I'm talking about. So I'd say materialism sort of gets the movement going historically toward this view that humans are just a machine, or maybe in the 19th century, once we get evolutionary theory on board, just an animal and don't have any larger significance than that.
Where does it go from there? Where does this notion that man is a mechanism and then later kind of fleshed out as a mechanism that is the product of blind chance and impersonal forces, where does it lead philosophically in the thinking of those kind of higher echelons of academia that eventually finds its way into, well, as you mentioned before, the anti-Semitism of Nazism was a popular viewpoint well outside of Germany in the early 1900s.
Certainly. Well, historically what happens is that these materialist philosophers, they're the radical fringe of the Enlightenment. That's why they're known as the Radical Enlightenment. They're not the mainstream Enlightenment. So they're a radical fringe at the time. But they're still fairly well respected in a lot of circles, too. I mean, their books are selling. They're discussed in the salons in Paris. They are they're wined and dined by Frederick the Great in Prussia. He accepted Lemaître in his palace for a time. So these are people who are well respected in many ways, but they are still a very small minority. But over the course of the 19th century, these ideas begin to grow, especially by the mid to late 19th century. These ideas about materialism begin to grow, and in the 20th century become even more prominent, especially in intellectual circles at the universities among professors and professionals and such. And today, then, these ideas are even expanding all the more. However, if we ask the question, where logically do those things lead, then it becomes more difficult because, there are lots of different manifestations of the materialist philosophies and other kinds of secular philosophies that are coming about in the 19th and on into the 20th centuries. And I discuss a whole host of them. Existentialism, for example, is very different from, let's say, more scientific materialism or something. But both of them share this view that humans don't have any kind of transcendent purpose or meaning. Maybe they can create their own meaning. Maybe the existentialist viewpoint or postmodernist viewpoint, they can create their own meaning, but they don't have any real meaning in a kind of objective sense or something outside of themselves. And so logically, where this leads us to is the place where human life really has no purpose, meaning, or value, and thus it becomes open to our own subjective viewpoints as to what we, what value we could give to that. And very often, what happens is we end up with notions of human inequality in many of these worldviews, where certain humans are considered, well, in the more more technical terms that are used today in bioethics, certain people are persons, certain humans are persons, and others are non-persons. Or, you know, in the Nazi scheme of things, it was certain people were fit to live and others were not fit to live, or they were the higher races or the subhuman races, or they were those with unworthy of life was a term being used also in Nazi period. Now, if we look at the communists, however, of course, opposite politically, very different world kind of view, but also an atheistic worldview. The communists believed that certain classes were not fit to live or fit to survive. And so human bourgeoisie, for example, Lenin declares war on the bourgeoisie. So they may have different ways of categorizing humans, but they tend to end up with this human inequality where certain humans have value and others don't. But it's based on their own subjective preferences.
So it is at its very foundation an abandonment of the idea of intrinsic value that is common to all human beings. The next logical step there is, well, then let's start talking about levels of value that different human beings might possess.
Exactly. And Peter Singer, who's one of the most prominent bioethicists in the world today, he's been named Time Magazine, if I recall correctly, by some major magazine anyway, as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. He has an endowed chair at Princeton University. He clearly argues that some humans are persons and some are non-persons, and he would argue that non-persons includes not only unborn babies, but also even babies after they are born, that they still don't have what he considers high enough cognitive capacities and capacities to plan for the future and other kinds of things that he thinks it takes to be a person. And so he relegates them to non-personhood, and people with other kinds of cognitive disabilities or with dementia toward the end of their life would also be defined by him as non-persons. And so then we open the doors then to killing these human beings because we define them as being in some other category of non-persons. And so this is the kind of thing that concerns me, that we think that we then can kill babies in the womb, but even after the womb in many cases with bioethics today, and people toward the end of their life, we think their lives no longer have any value or significance.
Dr. Richard Weikart is our guest. We're talking about secular philosophies and the culture of death when we come back. It was bad enough that a few races were considered to be plague species back in the Nazi days. Today, the entire human race considered by some to be a plague species. We'll talk about that after this.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $100 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship. Or you can make your $100 check payable to Issues Etc. Write Scholarship in the memo line and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about secular philosophies and the culture of death. Dr. Richard Weikart is our guest. The philosophies we're talking about are all over the place in the university and college system today. They're being pushed from the ivory tower of academia with a lot of force, and your grandchild or child needs to be equipped against these ideas that lead to a culture of death. A great organization to help in that respect and to keep them connected with solid Lutheran resources, congregations, and pastors is LCMSU. That's lcms.org/LCMSU. lcms.org/LCMSU. Dr. Weikart, I wonder, why does it always lead to killing? Why, if you're going to consider some race of people or some type of person less than human or without human rights, why not say, well, we're going to treat them like pets. We're going to protect them and nurture them and things like that. Why does it inevitably lead to, so we're going to kill them and exterminate them?
Well, great question, and I'm not sure why that would have to be the case. As you're suggesting, we can protect animals. In fact, Peter Singer is an animal rights activist, and he does believe we should be protecting animals to a great extent. But at the same time, you're right. In those people that get defined as non-persons, they don't have the same protection. He doesn't think they have any inherent right to life. And for example, as you're suggesting, he has argued very forthrightly that a newborn infant, human, has less value than a full-grown pig, for example. So when we slaughter the pig, we're actually doing a worse injustice than when we kill a newborn infant. But why we would then not protect those people? Because it's very interesting, because also in his book, Practical Ethics, he actually does argue that we should give the benefit of the doubt. If there's any question as to whether something actually has personhood, we should give the benefit of the doubt to that being. But then somehow he doesn't think that there's any doubt at all about the unborn child or even the child shortly after it's been born. He's very reluctant to draw any exact lines as to when there's no doubt that it doesn't have this personhood, but he's very convinced that, you know, in the first few weeks of its existence, that a baby doesn't have that characteristic of being a person.
Can you talk about how we got to this point? And this is probably, well, it's not more recent. It really is a time kind of dating, going back to our previous reference to the Nazis, when certain races, as they would have said, were in need of extermination because they were kind of a plague species. That's come to the point now, as you well know, Dr. Weikart, where some would even posit that the entire human race is a plague species.
Yes, in fact, I even use that term. I quote, as someone that uses that term. When the London Zoo put humans on display in 2005, they had this temporary display of volunteers, of course, of humans who were on display in the zoo. And the point of the display was to try to get us to realize that we're just another animal. And one of the things that they used in that, in the publicity surrounding the display, they actually used the term humans as being a plague species. That was a term that was used there. And of course, there are a lot of radical environmentalists who are around today who are promoting the idea that we should radically reduce the human population because there's too many of us on the globe. And I do give an example in the introduction of my book, too, of one of those, Eric Pion, who's a professor of evolutionary ecology at the University of Texas, who in 2006 gave a speech in which he claimed that he thought that it would be a good thing if 90% of the human population were wiped out by Ebola. So these are the kinds of dehumanizing ideas that are out there where people are thinking that humans not only are not valuable, but would be better off without a lot of us.
Laws can be pesky things, especially laws that are built upon presuppositions of intrinsic human rights, like the right to life. You write about Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. and how he was rather willing to dispense with that basic notion that undergirds so much of our laws. Tell us about it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And in light of the fact that we have a Supreme Court nomination that's going to be coming up here in the next president, it's interesting to look back at this particular historical case, because Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who was really was a darling of the progressives in the early part of the 20th century, did not believe that humans had a right to life. He made this very clear in his writings and especially in his private correspondence, where he came out very clearly in support of infanticide for infants who he thought were for infants with disabilities of various sorts. And thus, when he made a court ruling in 1927 in the Buck versus Bell decision, which he wrote the decision for in support of compulsory sterilization, he said that he thought that was one of the most important, more important kinds of reforms that could go on today. That is, that we have this compulsory sterilization so that we can rid ourselves of those with various kinds of defects. Now, of course, in compulsory sterilization, you're not actually killing someone, but of course, you're sterilizing someone. And most people, certainly by the 1950s and 60s, most people were turning away from the idea that compulsory sterilization was a way to carry on this eugenics program. But Holmes thought this was a great idea, and he also thought that infanticide was also, he thought, a legitimate method to carry this on as well.
So that's within our borders. That's within 100 years. Of this conversation here, going back not that far, has that idea stuck in law? You talked about the prospect of one or two Supreme Court nominees. Should people listening to us be concerned about that kind of idea still rattling around in the head of someone who may don a justice's robe in the near future?
Well, I think it would be a key concern because these ideas are still out there, and if you look at law school reviews and other things like that, many of these ideas about infanticide are coming back in and becoming very mainstreamed in, at least in bioethics circles and the higher echelons. And let me give an example of this too. Just about 4 years ago, if I recall correctly, I think it was 2012, there was an article that came out in the Journal of Medical Ethics, one of the leading journals in the world that's published on the field of medical ethics. The article was supporting what they called afterbirth abortion. So essentially it's calling for infanticide, but it doesn't want to use the term infanticide. It basically was playing upon the notion that abortion is more widely accepted than infanticide. So instead of calling it infanticide, we'll just call it afterbirth abortion. But their point was that birth doesn't really mark a key dividing line that should give value one way or the other to the individual. And so in this sense, actually, they're supporting the pro-life position that pro-lifers have been arguing for years, which is that birth is not a key dividing point. And Peter Singer, by the way, also concedes this very point. So once they've argued, though, that the point of birth is not a significant dividing line that should give value to a human being, they actually argue the opposite of what the pro-lifers argue by saying that means we should be able to kill them after birth. And pro-lifers, of course, argue that means we shouldn't kill them before birth. And so they take the argument the opposite direction. So these are kind of ideas that are becoming mainstream in a lot of bioethics circles, and these are going to filter into the legal system if we allow it. Now, fortunately, the Supreme Court has not, on the case of euthanasia, argued that there's any kind of right to euthanasia. The last case that came to the Supreme Court in the 1990s, they basically left it to the states. They allowed for euthanasia, but they didn't, or physician-assisted suicide, but they didn't mandate it as a human right, which is what some people were hoping to do. Obviously, there are some countries now, Belgium, Netherlands, Switzerland, where physician-assisted suicide is becoming ever and ever more expanding in scope. And in the United States, there are more and more states that are beginning to enact physician-assisted suicide, such as California, which just enacted it this past year, and in June 9th is actually going to go into effect here. So we now have 5 states in the United States that have physician-assisted suicide. So these issues, whether they be end-of-life issues of physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia or beginning-of-life issues, abortion, infanticide, they're still very key legal issues that are there's going to be this new Supreme Court that's coming in, new justices, I should say, coming in, are going to have an impact on those questions.
Are you concerned about a rather popular political philosophy, that of Ayn Rand, and not only its roots, but where it will inevitably lead in terms of its results?
Yeah, I discuss Ayn Rand's philosophy in the last chapter of my book, where I look at what I call the future of humanity, and I look at a number of utopian and dystopian writings of the past couple of centuries. I actually start off with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and then move on from there. But yes, I am very concerned about Ayn Rand, as well as many other secular philosophies, which try to boil everything down to, in her view, selfishness, that we're supposed to operate according to our own selfish values. As a Christian, I find this horrifying, and I believe that that the highest moral value is love, not selfishness, which is what she promotes, and not, as Peter Singer and other utilitarians argue, they argue that pleasure is the highest good, the highest measure of morality. And I have a whole chapter in my book, too, on the love of pleasure. And I see that our whole society, even if they're not, you know, intellectuals, you know, arguing for pleasure on a utilitarian kind, using utilitarianism as a basis for that, our society is being saturated by the notion that that pleasure is what we should be seeking after, even if they haven't put it into an ethical system. But there are intellectuals who actually have this as an ethical system, that pleasure is the highest good, and it's called utilitarianism, and it's very prominent among intellectuals today. And Ayn Rand sort of fits into this idea of selfishness is the highest good, just pursue after your own selfishness. And so she appeals to a lot of people who want freedom and who feel the constraints of big government, and so I can understand why people are sort of drawn to this idea of, you know, we want more freedom and autonomy and such. But basically, she just reduces us down to we're just a bunch of selfish creatures, and there's really no room for love in that universe, from what I can tell.
When we come back from this break, we're going to wrap up our conversation with Dr. Richard Weikart, talking about secular philosophies and the culture of death. Is there a common fatal flaw in all the secular philosophies, some of which we don't have time to discuss, that lead to this culture of death? Then Pastor Chris Roseborough will join us. We'll do This Week in Pop American Christianity on this Friday afternoon, talking about the recent Azusa Now revival, and we'll play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week in the last 20 minutes of the program. You can vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Send us an email with your vote, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet @issuesetc. When we come back, a few more minutes on the secular philosophies and the culture of death with Dr. Richard Weikart.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What would you say if someone asked you to explain the Trinity? Would you begin with Scripture, the creeds, or some clever analogy? And how are Christ and the gospel at the center of this fundamental Christian teaching? Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Beckwith has written a new book in the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatic series. It's titled The Holy Trinity. You can save $5 by pre-ordering The Holy Trinity at logia.org, L-O-G-I-A.org.
Cradled in historic Perry County, Missouri, the manger of the Missouri Synod, Emmanuel Lutheran Church at 453 Northwest Street in Perryville proclaims God's Word and celebrates His Supper on Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 7:30 and 10 using the church's liturgy contained in Lutheran Service Book, enriched with ancient and modern hymns. For more information, call 573-547-8317 or visit www.emmanuel-perryville.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about secular philosophies and the culture of death. Just a few more minutes with Dr. Richard Weikart. He's professor of modern European history at California State University, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, and author of the new book, The Death of Humanity and the Case for Life. Dr. Weikart, let's talk, kind of to summarize all of this, about if there is a fatal flaw that runs through all of these secular philosophies, some of which we don't have time to discuss. Is there a common fatal flaw that leads to a culture of death?
Well, I think the common flaw that I'm trying to focus on in my book, I mean, I think there's other things too, but I think the common flaw that I'm trying to focus on in my own book is that they reduce humans to machines or mere animals, but reduce them in any case to just matter in motion in one way or another, And then because of that, they claim that there's no meaning or purpose or significance, at least in any kind of overarching sense. They might say, oh, yeah, we can give ourselves purpose, we can give ourselves meaning and such. I have, you know, my day-to-day mundane purposes, but they don't think there's anything beyond that. But what I argue in my book is that in many cases, they know better. And if you probe deeply enough into their thinking, you'll find that they can't live consistently with that. They can't even talk consistently with that. And let me give one good example of that that I bring forward in my book that I think is a very telling example. That's Bertrand Russell, who is one of the most prominent philosophers of the early 20th century. And Russell argued that humans' ideas and loves and desires and everything are all what he called an accidental collocation of atoms. So it's just a matter of how your atoms have, you know, come about. You know, it's totally determined and such. And so in this view, there is no overarching purpose to the universe. And he even said concerning morality, and I do deal with this issue very extensively in my book too, their views of morality in the their rejection of the objectivity of morality. He said of morality that morality is just an emotion. So there's no real objectivity to it. It's not inscribed in the universe in any kind of way. It's just something that we feel. It's our emotion. But if you look at Russell's life, he had this very interesting quest for a deity. And even he doesn't really talk about this in public, but in his private correspondence he does, and I've got some really good quotations in my book where Bertrand Russell makes these comments about his quest for this divine being that he doesn't think exists, but he still says it gives meaning to his life, interestingly. And so Bertrand Russell had this quest for meaning. And if you look at morality, Bertrand Russell was extremely moralistic, and his own daughter, in reflecting on her life with him in a book that she wrote about her relationship with him, said that he was an absolutist in his morality. So on the one hand, he denies morality and any objectivity in morality. On the other hand, he lives his life in a way that he knows that there really is morality. And then one last example from his life, he spent time in jail protesting against nuclear arms. Why is he protesting against nuclear arms? Because he knows that it's wrong for us to be blowing up other humans and killing people, especially civilians. So at some level, he knows that human life really has value. He knows there really are moral values. He really does have compassion and love at some level for other people, but his whole philosophy denies all of that.
Dr. Richard Weikart is professor of modern European history at California State University, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture, and author of the new book, The Death of Humanity and the Case for Life. You can find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Weikart, thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thanks for having me.